goes into the side of the coax. The ham radio operators do that. I know that you guys are going to be a lot more scientific, but I guarantee there's a zillion ways you could put a impedance matching device, as long as it's close enough to the perturbation, a small enough number of wavelengths, it is correctable without creating intersymbol distortion. KE2EJ, K2RIW, is that a possible approach in your case, Eric?
No, I'll give you this. The coax is 6 1/8 inch diameter. It's big and heavy. And it's going to get replaced for free. So I'll take the new stuff. It's a better solution. Besides, I would much rather have a system that's really spot on for what we're doing instead of trying to make do. Let's put it this way. You've got all that length of cable running up the tower, and you don't really want to have to go up there and literally throw the stuff up there. I mean, you can do it all on the ground with a good DNA and a good operator, but given the circumstances, replacement of this 40-year-old, this 35-year-old coax is not such a bad thing, and also it has had its day in terms of when the segments shorted out and arced over and melted Teflon, even though it's pressurized with nitrogen. There's still little bits and pieces along the way, so to speak, even after the bad segments were replaced. So, you know, carbon that's been deposited and that kind of stuff, I'd rather get rid of it. K2RW, K2J.
One of the things that's only slightly known, it first came to my attention by Radio Society of Great Britain 20 or so years ago, is that there's a very crafty way of making an impedance match between two mismatches of cable. Assuming I've got an antenna that's 200 feet away from the shack, and the only thing I own is 100 feet of 50-ohm cable and 100 feet of 75-ohm cable. The only way I'm going to bridge the 200 feet, because I'm a poor guy and I can't go out and buy more cable, is to simply connect those two pieces of cable together and cascade it. So I've got a 50-ohm cable for the first 100 feet, 75-ohm cable for the next 100 feet, and I've just rammed the two together. That will, at that junction, 75 divided by 50, will be a 1.5 to 1 standing wave ratio. That'll be a quarter of your power being reflected. That is, I don't know, it's less than a quarter of the power, but let's see now, 1.5 to 1. Yeah, I think it's like 15 dB down is the reflection coefficient. It's going to give you something like a few tenths of a dB of insertion loss. A 2 to 1 standing wave ratio only gives you half a dB of loss. So you're going to get a little bit of loss because of the reflection. It's not real loss. It's apparent loss, meaning that the throughput energy is lowered because of that interface. Now, there's a zillion ways that you can put something at the junction of the 50-ohm cable and the 75-ohm cable to make them thoroughly happy with each other. Let me drop. You could put an RF matching transformer with the right number of primary to secondary turns ratio that matches 50 to 75 ohms. That's the brute force approach. You could put a quarter wave matching transformer. You could put a quarter wavelength of line, which is the diameter, which is the geometric mean. You take 50 times 75. Let's do that right now. 50, enter, 75. You can tell I'm using an RPM machine. Multiply, take square root, and the answer is 61.2. If I built a phony piece of coax cable, I go to my hobby shop and I buy the right diameters of copper tubing, and I make a phony piece of coax cable, which is quarter wavelength long at my operating frequency, which is 62 ohm impedance, and I put it between the 50 ohm cable and the 75 ohm cable at that operating frequency, where it's a quarter wavelength long, I get a perfect impedance match. That's the so-called quarter wave matching transformer. Now, the quarter wave matching transformer, right now we've made one with 62 ohms by making a quarter wavelength of constant impedance at the geometric mean of the impedance between those two cables. Let me drop. What this beautiful article in the RSGV said is you can use the dual 12th of a wavelength approach. If at the end of the 50-ohm cable, I put a 12th of a wavelength of 75-ohm cable, followed by a 12th of a wavelength of 50-ohm cable, followed by the rest of the 75 ohm cable. So I've made this phony matching device in between by using a small piece of 50 and a small piece of 75. I am now synthesizing 62 ohm cable by using carefully chosen lengths of the 50 and 75 ohm cable that I already own. That's called the tarpa wavelength approach. Works like a charm. And at first you look at that and you say, how the hell can that work so easily? In the real world, putting all those connectors in there to match those is a little bit of a pain. The average guy does it by soldering the center conductor and the shields together and using no connector at all. Let me drop this. Along those lines, in the last week, I suddenly made a discovery. If I decide that I want to splice pieces of cable by using assemblies of UHF connectors, PL-259 and SO-238, if I use two PL-259s and an SO-238, I get this 34-degree length at 432, 34-degree length of 30-ohm cable, which is going to give me a predictable amount of reflection. And now, what's the easiest way to correct that? I could put a tuning stub in there, I could put a tuning transformer in there, I could put a quarter-wave matching transformer in there. There's a more sophisticated approach. You would never believe what the answer is.
Probably do it.
Take that assembly of connectors and do it again. In other words, the splice not consist of a PL-59, an SO-238, and a PL-259. Do two of those splices very closely spaced with something like 6 inches of cable, 50 ohm cable, between them, and it becomes a perfect impedance match. It's a subset of the 12th of a wavelength approach. So there's a magic length of cable in between a pair of those splicing assemblies. For each frequency, there's a magic length of cable where you get a perfect impedance match. Now, the average guy is not going to want to do that. It's a hell of a lot of connectors. On top of that, many of us make the mistake of believing that because a SO-239 connector on the front, on the back panel of all of our transmitters, let me drop this. Because that connector is approximately a 30 ohm connector, a non-constant impedance connector, lots of us want to remove that connector because we think each one of them is going to give a half a dB of loss, dead wrong, but a lot of people believe that, and they're going to replace it with a type N connector, and they think they're going to get all kinds of benefits. No way in hell. That connector is there because it's very rugged, can take very high power. The only thing you can fault that connector for is that out in the air, it's not very well weatherproofed. But other than that, it's an extremely rugged connector that can easily take multiple kilowatts, and it's inexpensive, and it's been around for 60 years because it gives you so much bang for the dollar, and it gives you so little insertion loss. Now, when it comes to real loss, you see an apparent loss in throughput energy because of some of the energy reflected, because it has a 30-ohm impedance of a certain electrical length at your operating frequency. Let me drop. But just like energy cannot be created or destroyed, reflected energy is not immediately lost. If that reflected energy goes way down a long piece of coax cable that's got insertion loss, and then gets re-reflected by an antenna tuner, and bouncing back and forth between the tuner and that assembly, yes, you get some extra loss. But it's not real loss in the I squared R approach. It's not getting hot. Here's the way I proved it. I took a pair of PL-259s and an SO-238, married them together. I did this 20 years ago. I put 700 watts of 432 energy through that for 10 solid minutes. I took my parallel kilowatt K2RIW amplifier, 700 watts of output, put it through that UHF connector assembly going up to my antenna, poured 700 watts into it for 10 solid minutes. Let me drop. At the end of the 10 minutes, I touched the connector assembly. It was mildly warm to my hand. Mildly warm is approximately 1 watt of real loss, real I squared R insertion loss. 1 watt of loss out of 700 watts is 0.01 dB of insertion loss. That's the real insertion loss of a PL-259 SO-238 connector assembly. That's the real loss, I squared R loss. The only thing that has loss is something that has length. You cannot get significant loss with zero length. Those connectors have got very little length. The connector on the back panel, the PL-259 or the SO-239 connector on the back of your transmitter has so little length, it has no mechanism of loss. It creates a little bit of reflection of signal, but the transmitter is readjusted for that, so you don't even know it. So as you can tell, these connectors have got a lot more capability, and all of these old wives' tales we keep hearing about half a dB of loss for each one of those is pure bull. It's not real loss. Any further comments on all of the above? Eric first. K2EJ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, I do have to make a transition from 75 ohms to 50 ohms, and the way we do it is pretty interesting. Actually, that's something else instead of saying. Now, as you might know, the diameter of the tennis conductor is 75 ohms versus 50 ohms. It's considerable difference in size. And the impedance transition is actually made by another little piece of pipe that makes that transition in size from the bigger pipe to the smaller pipe, and it needs to be a quarter wavelength long. And that works pretty well. There's something else I was going to say now for that. Oh well, forget. Yeah. Having to deal with all this stuff and get it down to these small numbers is quite an interesting piece of engineering when you finally think about it. Well, one thing I will say in terms of connectors making those interconnections, as you get up into higher frequencies, that's where SMA connectors and good SMA connectors come into play, and tightening them up with the torque wrench, with the proper torque, makes a huge amount of difference that most people don't realize.
I've personally seen that at 10 gigs, where I was doing this great big radar experiment at the anechoic chamber at Edwards Air Force Base. We were doing it at 10 gigahertz, and if you didn't properly torque the SMA connectors, each individual connector without proper torquing will give you a little bit of reflected energy, and in the particular system I was working on, I couldn't tolerate the small amount of reflected energy you get from the tiny, tiny air gap you get into a SMA connector if it's not properly torqued. Now, of all the techniques for matching impedance between 50 and 75 ohms, transformer is one. Quarter wave matching transformer of 62 ohms is one. The 12th wavelength pair technique is another one. The Minerva line is the extremely sophisticated one. If that center conductor in your case, between the 50 ohm line and 75 ohm, if it slowly tapered from one diameter to the other over a couple of wavelengths, not only would you get a perfect impedance match, but it would be an extremely broad band impedance match. That's called the Minerva line. Mr. Minerva, way back in 1940, invented that technique. The RF energy doesn't see the transition as long as the transition is a slow tapering transmission. It's a little like a lobster being put into a pot of cold water, and then you turn on the heat. He never knows he's being cooked, if you know what I mean. The water just very slowly gets hot, and he never feels it. So the RF energy is like that. RF energy, in certain cases, can be extremely tolerant of changes if you're smart enough in how you do it. I wonder if anybody has ever made a tapered line that would give you the impedance match in your case, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, actually, if I show you one, it's really interesting. It is actually, in essence, tapered, but it's done on the inside diameter, whereas you normally think about skin effects and how the RF travels on the outside. But in this case, it's done on the inside, the inner part of the conductor. How it makes that transition, where it actually sits on the bullet. So the bullets make the contact on the inside diameter of the semiconductor. And when you look at the device from the outside, it looks like you've got one pipe that's literally jammed into another pipe, and that it looks like it's got a perpendicular transition at that point. But if you look inside of the device, it's actually a slow slope taper that goes from the outer diameter or the inside diameter of one receptacle for the bullet at that end, or the pipe at that end, and it tapers to the inside diameter of the smallest pipe. So it doesn't look like anything, but it's amazing when you look at it on a VNA.
AC20.
Yeah, Bill recognized, we're going to get you in a minute, Bill. The two pieces of pipe you're joining, Eric, are the outside diameters the same and only the inside diameter is changing and tapering? Or is there two different diameters of 50 and 75 ohm output diameter, outside diameter and inside diameter? You could make the transition look like no transition at all if the outside diameters were the same and only the inside diameter is changing. And it's perfectly legal to taper only the inside diameter. Over to you, Eric, KQRIW.
I don't remember the exact numbers, but it's a significant difference between the outside diameter of the 75 ohm and the outside diameter of the 50 ohm. The thickness of the pipe itself is the same, well, it's not the same. It's not the same between the 75 and the 50, I think. The 50 is a little bit thinner. But the dimensions of the semiconductor is radically different from one another. And the transition is done on the inside. Don't forget the bullets contact the inside of the coax, or the inside of the semiconductor. And that's where the connections are made. So from the bigger pipe, there's a bigger bullet. And when you get to the smaller pipe, there's a smaller bullet. And if you look inside, it's a smooth transition between the two of them.
Real crafty. The average person who doesn't understand how waveguide works thinks that the waveguide has to be extremely precise in the inner dimensions and all the walls have to be mirror smooth. Therefore, if I took a piece of WR75, 0.75 inch width waveguide, and a piece of WR90, 9/10 of an inch waveguide, so I got 9/10 of an inch waveguide and 7/10 of an inch waveguide, and I slam the two together, flange to flange, hold them together with C-clamps. You look down that pipe, and you see that great big transition. It looks ugly as all hell. You assume that that microwave signal would never go down there. You actually do that experiment. You end up with an extremely small standing wave ratio. The RF almost doesn't know that that transition has occurred. So, and if you skew those two pieces of pipe just right, you can make the impedance match better by literally misaligning them in a particular manner, twisting and sliding them a little bit, and you can get a better alignment. To the eye, it looks ugly. To the RF, it looks better. Let's see what Bill's got to say. Over to you, Bill, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Thanks, Vic. Actually, my question kind of sounds a little bit like what you were just mentioning. Different size waveguides, I guess, but they were the same. I guess, just different physical sizes, but what I was wondering about was the Minerva line. You're saying, I guess, that these things don't have to be perfectly smooth. I was wondering if you had the equivalent of a Minerva line, but instead of a smooth transition, you got a step transition. How small would the step size need to be before you didn't really notice the significant SWR being created by the step size, ACQIN.
Yeah, same. Assuming we're making a tapered coaxial cable or a tapered piece of waveguide in order to match two different sizes of waveguide or two different pieces of coax. My gut feels that if each one of the steps has a length of a 12th of a wavelength or less, the RF would not see the steps. You could make the steps even bigger than that, the gaps between the steps even bigger. But then you'd have to do some additional balancing. Some of the steps would have to be slightly larger, slightly shorter, smaller, in order to give a good impedance match. But a 12th of a wavelength of transition as a step size, I believe the RF will not see it. Obvious by the fact that I can make this a perfect quarter wave matching transformer by using a pair of 12th wavelength chunks of coax and alternate them. Start off with a great big long 50 ohm cable, followed by a 12th of a wavelength of 75 ohm, followed by a 12th of a wavelength of 50 ohm, followed by the rest of the cable, all 75. So there's a pair of 12th wavelength things in the middle, and that acts like a quarter wave matching transformer. It acts like the 62 ohm. Even though you're mixing pieces of 50 and 75, it generates 62 ohm impedance as far as the RF is concerned, and it's extremely broadband a matching technique. It may be even an octave broad, if you know what I mean. So from that experience, that's why I'm saying, a 12th of a wavelength between the steps, I think the RF would not see the steps. It doesn't have to be perfectly smooth. And by the same token, that piece of waveguide that you are using, you think it's got to be mirror smooth and silver plated in order to be high in performance. Let me drop it. Mirror smooth, silver plated, dry nitrogen filled, or filled with sulfur hexafluoride, all of that jazz is not required. You'd be amazed how many bumps and grinds and dents and whatever. There are a number of filters that I have worked on in the past, which literally consist of chunks of waveguide with apertures and tuning screws in the side of a waveguide. You take a chunk of waveguide and you put some windows in it and put some screws in between those windows. It's called an evanescent technique filter. You're making intentional perturbations of the waveguide, but you're doing it periodically. You do it two or three times in a row, four times in a row, and you do it just right. You get a beautiful band pass or band stop filter, high pass, low pass, band stop, or whatever. And so, by the same token, I have taken some of these filters that were designed for, say, the 15 gigahertz region, and I wanted to use them at 10 gigahertz, where the tuning screws ran out of range. And what I literally did was to take a great big C-clamp and dent the waveguide. It's called dent tuning. If you're smart enough to know what you're doing, you create a dent in the broad wall. You take the two broad walls of the waveguide and squeeze them closer together, and all of a sudden, a evanescent filter that was made for 15 gigahertz works beautifully at 10 gigahertz. You'd be amazed how many antennas made out of waveguide have used dent tuning techniques. If you know what you're doing, you can intentionally make ugliness inside of that waveguide that is really RF sophisticated. AC2IS, K2RIW, over to you, Bill, for any further comments. K2RIW.
Hey, Dick, it sounded like you went back to talking about your impedance matching technique using lengths of cable, but what I was asking about, I think, is the Minerva line involves a taper, right? So if you don't have the ability to create a taper somehow, if you could only, approximate a taper with, changes in diameter, how small would these changes in diameter have to be before it was not noticed, before it did not create a significant SWR? AC2IS.
If I'm using a broadcast type cable where the center conductor in one case is an inch in diameter and the center conductor in the other case is a half inch in diameter, I'm going to do a slow taper between 1 inch and a half inch on that center conductor. My gut feel is if I did that not as a continuous taper over a couple of wavelength lengths, but I did it as individual steps, and I stepped up an eighth of an inch or a sixteenth of an inch. I think you could step an eighth of an inch, make eighth of an inch steps between 1 inch and a half inch. I think you'd be making four of those. If I make four of those steps, and each one of those steps is approximately a 12th of a wavelength long, yeah, it'd have to be a little bit longer than that. But there's ways of calculating this. One of the best ways, this is one of the places where computer modeling would work very well, HFSS, High Frequency Structure Simulator. You mechanically construct in the computer program that structure with those eighth of an inch or sixteenth of an inch steps every 12th of a wavelength, and how good an impedance match you would get. High Frequency Structure Simulator would tell you exactly whether or not you're going to get a 1.1 standing wave ratio out of that whole assembly, and whether or not it's going to be an octave broad. But without a doubt, it doesn't have to be a smooth taper. As long as the individual edges and lengths and steps are a small fraction of a wavelength, the RF energy does not see the step. Your eye, with high resolution, sees those steps. The RF does not. I'll give you another example. One of the more sophisticated microwave antennas is a so-called Cassegrain. A Cassegrain antenna is a parabolic reflector with a sub-reflector out in front, which is hyperbolic, much, much smaller in diameter, followed by a horn that's right at the apex of the dish. So in the center of the dish, you've got a horn that's aimed at the sub-reflector. The subreflector is a convex surface that's hyperbolic, which gives you a fancy reflection from the subreflector into the main reflector, and then from there the signal goes straight out into space, as if you had a feed horn way out in front of the antenna feeding this great big parabolic reflector. That's a Cassegrain antenna system. However, the good books will tell you, when you design that Cassegrain antenna system, if that subreflector is not at least 10 wavelengths in diameter, drop the design. Don't go any further. Okay? Now, here's where it really comes down, back to bite you. Let me drop. There's a hell of a lot of microwave enthusiasts on the 10 gig handband that buy an 18-inch diameter KU band satellite receiving system. They buy that 18-inch diameter dish, offset-fed parabolic dish, or an equivalent. Maybe they're buying a 2-foot or a 3-foot real center-fed parabolic reflector, and they build a subreflector that's a little bit 1 or 1.5 inches in diameter. Well, at 10 gigahertz, a wavelength is approximately 1 inch. The subreflector is now, in their case, only going to be 1 or 1.5 inches in diameter. It's only going to be 1 or 1.5 wavelengths in diameter. It's way outside of that rule of thumb. It should be 10 wavelengths. And after these guys design this thing, they then start asking each other, the subreflector has to be a hyperbolic surface, and what accuracy do you need in the hyperbolic surface? Does it have to be built to the nearest 32nds of an inch or the nearest 64ths of an inch? And the answer, it doesn't matter. You could literally make it as a so-called penny feed. You could make it a completely flat device, 1 inch or 1.5 inches in diameter, and you get the same performance. What's going on here is that the RF energy cannot see something that is a wavelength or less in diameter. If your eyes operated at 10 gigahertz, and you looked at that subreflector that's 1 inch in diameter, 1 wavelength diameter, it would look like a white dot in space. You couldn't tell whether it was concave or convex when it's that small in wavelengths at that operating frequency. The RF cannot see it. Very similar to what your eye is doing. When your eye is looking at an object, you're holding that book in front of you and you're reading the type. Your eye has something like 80 wavelengths of diameter.
Repeater, time out.
The iris of your eye has something like 80 wavelengths in diameter at the optical operating frequency. Your eye, a good human eye, has an angular resolution of 1 minute of arc. 1/60th of a degree is what you can resolve. So when you're using a optical system, looking at your piece of waveguide, and you're looking at something with 1/60th of a degree of resolution, but the real RF energy at 10 gigahertz looking at that dish has an angular resolution of 3 degrees, you can see why the RF doesn't see these fine details unless the dish gets much bigger and the subreflector gets much bigger. AC2IS, K2RIW, go ahead, Bill.
Thanks, Dick. I guess, talking about these lengths, how significant they are, and I guess the length between each step. How does that relate to if you're creating this taper? I guess the taper cannot be too abrupt, even if it is, you know, optically smooth. Is this length per step that you're talking about related to the length that a perfect taper would have to be? How long does that perfect taper have to be in order to be effective? AC2IS.
You could make the taper exactly a quarter wavelength long, but it would be relatively narrow band. It'll give you a perfect match at one frequency. As you make the tapered section a smooth taper, more and more wavelength long, it becomes more and more broadband. I don't know the exact number, but if you look at Mr. Minerva's article, he's going to tell you. My gut feel is if you made the taper 10 wavelengths long, my guess is that that taper would be at least 1 and maybe 2 octaves broad if your definition is where does it not exceed 1.2 standing wave ratio. Numbers like that. So a couple of wavelengths long of smooth taper will work like a charm and be fairly broadband. And now you start building subsets of that where you're building it not as a smooth taper, but individual steps. And if the individual steps, in my example of tapering from 1 inch down to a half inch, if it's done in 1/16 of an inch or 1/8 of an inch steps, and if each of those steps is a fraction of a wavelength in spacing between the steps, I think the RF would not see the difference, if you know what I mean. So there's some magic distance between the steps, and there's some magic step size where the RF cannot tell the difference between a smooth taper and your stepped taper. Over to you, Bill. I know that's not an exact answer, but at least you see the philosophy. That's up. If the RF energy, if you make believe your eyes operated at that frequency, if my eyes operated at 10 gigs, I can barely resolve an object with 1 inch dimension, just barely resolve it, if you know what I mean. Whereas my human eye can easily see a 1/64th of a wavelength of a ripple in that subreflector, because my eyes are operating a million times higher in frequency. Let me drop it. To put this in more exact terms, you and I, as UHF ham radio operators, Bill, we've got a gut feel for what is 600 megahertz. If I go a million times higher in frequency than 600 megahertz, that's the middle of the optical band where your eye operates. Your eye is operating at a wavelength or at a frequency 1 million times higher than 600 megahertz. AC2IS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2LIW.
Oh, go ahead, Eric.
Now, one thing I wanted to point out in these impedance transitions that I have, they look really good over the 6 megahertz that it's designed for. But as soon as you go away on either side, you start to see the visual of that transition start to grow very rapidly.
In your case, the transition has what length? Eric, is that roughly a quarter wavelength long? Or is it multiple quarter wavelengths long?
Each segment of it, from where it starts to where it ends, is slightly more than a quarter wavelength.
And how many segments of a quarter wavelength each are there?
No, it's one smooth transition. It's, oh gee, I actually have to measure it if I want to be precise about it. But it's about a quarter wavelength at the operating frequency, and it's one segment. It's not, you know, it's not steps like you're talking about. It's just nice, smooth transition.
And that thing gives you your very high performance. You're looking for a 1.05 or whatever standing wave ratio across 6 megahertz at roughly 500 megacycles of 30 center frequency. So you're looking for, in the vicinity of 1.5% bandwidth at your high performance. And so a Minerva line that would do that for, say, a 5% bandwidth, I think would have to be a number of wavelengths long in that transition, Eric. KE2EJ, K2IW.
Yeah, I can see that. Actually, I'm going to try and work out the map. By the way, which model of the HP calculator do you use? Because, interestingly enough, there's a guy making apps that duplicate that. I think it's an M48 or an M8. There's a number of different calculators, so I don't know what you use for a phone, but it's nice to be able to have that there.
I own a number of HP 48s, which has got the plug-in card, but my favorite one that I've been using for the last 4 years is HP 50G, HP 50 Golf graphic calculator. It has 2,500 functions built into its ROM. I can speak to it in 6 languages: Algebraic, Basic, Fortran, Lisp, and Forth. I can write 1 line of code in all 6 languages, and it knows what the hell I'm asking for it to do as long as I use the right syntax. So I can have it speak to me in spherical coordinates, cylindrical coordinates, rectangular coordinates, 3-axis, 2-axis, 4-axis. It'll invert a complex matrix that's a 16 by 16. It'll give me graphic display on that screen, which is a hidden line graphic, a three-dimensional object, and I can ask it to locate that object on the screen. It is my electronic, all of the phone numbers and names and addresses of everybody I know, I've entered into that program, into that calculator. It's not intended to do that. I just wrote myself a little program that does that. So it suits my needs very nicely, Eric. And the best thing that Hewlett-Packard ever did. Let me drop. And if you study how in the world can a machine that's that elaborate, a few people have found a way because they love the functions that are built into it. I mean, one of the functions built into it is Fourier transform, and another function is reverse Fourier transform. You can give it a whole matrix of data and press the key labeled Fourier transform, and it goes to a subroutine that's built into the ROM and does that answer for you. So the people who have put a connecting cable between this handheld calculator and their desktop calculator because they love the access to those functions that are built into that machine. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
Yeah, KQRIW, KE2EJ. Well, I'm looking at what I've got, which is the 48. So I'm going to look and see if they have their 50. Although I'm having a good time with this thing. It's, you know, it's on my iPhone, but it does everything that it does, you know, that the 48 does, and it does it very well.
Yeah, when I compare a 48, I own two 48s as well as a 50. If I look at all the functions I've got in the 48 and all the functions I've got in the 50, and if somebody asks me what was added, I'm going to say about 10% was added. There's 10% more stuff and a little bit more user-friendliness in the 50 than there is in the 48. You've got 90% of what you ever would desire. If you're a 50G calculator lover and you own a 48, you've got 90% of anything you'd ever want, Erica. Go ahead.
All right. Well, I downloaded this about 2 weeks ago, and I've been having a wonderful time using it, and I haven't even discovered most of the functions that are built into it, but I like the way it grabs, I like the way you plot stuff, and do really what appear to be simple equations, but and not quite that simple, but quite a bit of engineering.
If I'm doing transmission line functions, where I'm mixing impedances, doing stub matching and whatever, a Smith chart is a beautiful way of visualizing what's happening. But a very careful use of a Smith chart requires paper, compass, ruler, calculations, plots, experience, and you get an answer with about two decimal places of accuracy. I've got a computer program, which is really a single equation. There is an equation, which has got five sines and cosines in it. It's got two sines and cosines in the numerator and two sines and cosines in the denominator and a bunch of constants in between. You plug in the parameters to that equation, which wants to know what is the impedance you're starting with, what's the impedance of the first line, what's the impedance of the transmission line, what's the impedance, what's the complex impedance of the load, what's the number of wavelengths or degrees of length of that transmission line. And if when I put that all together, put that complex load on the end of that crazy transmission line. Let me give you an example. I got a 30 ohm length of line, 34 degrees long, terminated with a 50 ohm load. 30 ohm characteristic impedance line, 34 degrees long, terminated with 50 ohms. What's the input impedance? You give this computer program those three parameters: operating frequency, E0, Z load, and line length. Let me drop. And you press go, the computer program plugs the numbers into the equation, solves the equation, gives you the answer, converts the answer into standing wave ratio, dB reflection coefficient. From the time I give that program that data and I press the key go, within a tenth of a second, all of that information appears across the six lines of that screen. Everything I want to know. That's handy. So in other words, I can now do Smith chart calculations with nearly 12 decimal places of accuracy, as if the Smith chart was in front of me. I'm electronically doing a Smith chart. I don't need the paper and pencil anymore once I've got that equation. So in the case of these DL-259, SO-239 things, you can see I can easily find out what is the impact at this frequency and what have I got to do to impedance match it. And I can even tell the program, choose for me the length of line between the pair of those transitions. I'm now using that splicing device twice, and I'm putting a magic length of line between them, and there's some magic length of line that'll give a perfect impedance match, and I can go to what's called the solve function, S-O-L-V-E, and I tell it, keep modifying the length of that line until the reflection coefficient goes to zero energy. And in a fraction of a second, it gives me that answer with 12 decimal places. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
Yeah, K2RIW, K2J. Now, I'm beginning to program this thing. Actually, this is a 49G+, which they say is not quite, but it's almost the same as a 50G. But anyway, I should have had one of these years and years ago. It's quite a nice device. I've used a lot of graphic calculators, which basically you enter the equation in as the correct equation nomenclature, and that's worked out for a lot of stuff, but the flexibility of this is so much easier than having to, you know, to write a formula out as opposed to just pushing buttons.
Algebraic equations in complex mathematics, you can put them across that screen and have it plug in the parameters for you, solve for any one of those things. In other words, take this very complicated equation where it's got five terms, and now tell the program to rearrange the equation so that the third term is on the left-hand side of the equal sign and everything else is on the right, and it'll go and do that for you. So these Hewlett-Packard pocket calculators give you a hell of a lot of the capability of a desktop, but now it's in your pocket, portable, as you walk around doing your job. And so, as such, I almost never do any technical calculating with a desktop computer. My desktop computer gives me internet interface. I can search Google with that and get my email, if you know what I mean. And nowadays, I guess the iPhones will give you even that. But the iPhone doesn't have as much function as the HP 49G or the HP 50G. But in your pocket these days, there's an awful lot of computing power. And the computer that got the astronauts to the moon, I think was about the equivalent of a Commodore 64. What do you think, Eric? K2EJ, K2IW.
Actually, the Apollo computer was something like a 4004. But anyway, now, when I'm doing VSC stuff, I use MathCAD. You know, I write it out symbolically. Because I got to figure out the coefficients, and I'm usually using an FFT and a reverse FFT, and I can take it out to as many decimal places as I want. But, you know, when you get up into thousands of taps, even your VSC is going to slog down on it. So, the typical fill filter that I write is maybe 49-50 tabs, so it's just reasonable. But having this thing on my iPhone has been quite amazing for me, especially here at work when I'm trying to figure stuff out. Although it does take me a little while to program the functions that I want. So I'm not good at Lisp. I'm not good at a few other things. I can do it in Fortran. I prefer C, but of course it doesn't do that.
Yeah, the big problem you and I run into is that from time to time we'll write a very sophisticated program. We'll store it somewhere. And at the time we're using it, boy, it's handy as all hell. You come back a year later and you say, what the hell is this and how do I use it? Well, I love to have a computer program that is self-documenting. The way I write all my computer programs on the HP 50G is that the program... I put the program on the screen. So the program is stored in its memory. And the program has a fancy name. RS Calculate. RS Calculate number one. So I take RS Calculate number one and say, display it on the screen for me. Display the program on the screen for me. And the first six lines of the program are there, and I can scroll through it. The very first line of the program opens up with its double carat opening symbol, followed by a right-hand aimed arrow. And the right-hand aimed arrow says, if the right-hand arrow says F, L, and Z0, I know that what the program's going to do is going to take the three parameters I have put on that screen, F, L, and Z0. F is frequency. I can make it to FR for frequency. I can write out the exact thing. So frequency, length, and Z0, or length. So the program has an arrow, and after the arrow are those parameters. I know what the program is going to do is it's going to take the first three things that are off that screen and stuff them into those temporary variables. The very next step of the program is it's got an open parenthesis sign. The open parenthesis sign is followed by an equation. I know it's going to take those parameters and apply it to that equation.
Repeater, timeout.
By that process, the program becomes self-documenting. I can look at it a year later. I can tell by the title of the program and the parameters it uses, frequency, line length, and Z0, I know what it's about to do. It's about to do a transmission line calculation, and it's about to use that particular program that I recognize, that particular equation that I recognize. So I know exactly what the program is going to do. It is self-documenting. I don't need to write a comment statement. The first steps of the program tell me everything. Now, your iPhone, if I understand correctly, you've downloaded this thing into your iPhone, which simulates or emulates an HP 49G. Too bad you don't really own an HP 48 or 49G. By way of eBay, I guarantee you could get one in your hand for roughly $100 or $120, Eric, to have the real thing in your hand, which, by the way, will read out in infrared. By way of the infrared readout on the back panel of the HP calculator, you could then be talking with infrared into a Hewlett Packard printer if you wanted to print out what's on the screen. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
ACQIS query.
KQRIW, KQ gang. You can use it to send it out to the printer. It's got the same accuracy as the 49G. It's all software. It's software in the calculator. This thing was $9 as opposed to $100, so it'll do the job. But what I will say is that with MathCAD, when you create a worksheet, and you can comment it to all you want, and the title of the program will be enough. You've got the ability to put long English words and not have to come up with some system like you did use to keep in your pocket. So I'm slowly getting to the point where I'm starting to put stuff in there that I use on a regular basis. But, I'll still do it symbolically in MathCAD because it actually makes a lot more sense when you're looking at it.
Pro-recognized. Stand by a second, Bill. To not use a whole lot of lines of the screen, I make my variables brief. F for frequency or FR for frequency. I could make each one of my variables 16 characters long or longer if I wanted to. Just that when I now recall it to the screen, it's going to fill up a lot more lines of the screen and I have to do a lot more scrolling. So I can make my variables as many characters as I want, uppercase, lowercase, numbers in between, punctuation, and whatever.
Limited in screen size.
Yeah, the screen is, I think it's 16 characters wide, six lines. I think it's something like 16 characters long each screen. So I use more brief variables, floating variables, just to not fill up a whole lot of screen. But I'm not limited. I could make each one of my variables a sentence if I wanted to, Eric. Are you able to do MathCAD on your iPhone by way of the downloaded 49G program? Is that what you're saying, Eric? I haven't done MathCAD on my calculator, but maybe I might be able to do some of those functions. Over to you, Eric, KQRIW.
Well, what I have been doing up until I started playing with this, is I leave MathCAD running at home. Well, I leave my machine running at home, and on my iPhone, I go in via RDP, and I actually do my mass CAD manipulation on my machine at home, but through my iPhone, which is fine. I might get on another computer and dial up the machine at home and utilize the software that way. It doesn't make sense to try and reinvent the world every time you need to do something. I have a whole series of programs that I use on a regular basis that makes it rather convenient for me. And no, I simplify my variables. I actually declare them right at the beginning of the program. You can see what they are. But then again, the name of the program, like FFT for 46 taps, it's plain English, and you click the button, and there you go. You just pop in the variables and watch the answers here.
When I was working at Airborne Instruments Laboratory 20 or so years ago, they wanted to make sure that every engineer had a desktop computer that was connected to the master computing system in the building. The master computing system in the building, DDP-8 or something like that equivalent. And so of all the programs you wrote and stored, they were being stored on tape somewhere, and they always ran out of memory space and tape space and so on. So this great program that you were using to do your function as your job, you stored it on their system. And a month later, you tried recalling your program because you needed it again, and it wasn't there. They had to move it to archival storage. The archival storage was a tape drive. The tape drive, the index in the beginning got worn out, so the guy had to manually walk through the tape to find your program. Big rigmarole. The bottom line is I started using Hewlett-Packard handheld calculators to do everything I did. And the chief engineer found out I'm doing everything on a handheld calculator, and it's a very expensive system he put into the building. I was not using it. As far as he's concerned, let me drop it. From his point of view, I was a heretic. I was getting all the function I needed out of handheld pocket calculators, and the system that they were providing, as long as I was using the program every single day, everything was okay. If I came back a week later and I wanted to use that program and it wasn't there, it wasn't available to me, and it took me a couple of days to get it back, I'm complaining to the computing department. You can see how I gave up. And so internet hadn't yet really gotten popular yet, so I basically stopped using the desktop computer that they had paid big bucks for, because they really made it inconvenient compared to my handheld calculator. And I talked a number of my fellow engineers into joining me in that effort, and they were also using Hewlett-Packard calculators. And because they found out the chief engineer would be so unhappy if he found out about it, they were keeping it a secret. How are you, Eric? Keep your eyes, everybody.
Yeah, K2RIW, K2J. Well, I can see why the powers to be could be upset, because, any intellectual property you guys came up with, they want it. They want it in the be able to touch it with their hands. You're probably either doing PDP-11, RC-11. The disk drives were probably, 10 megabytes each or 20 megabytes each, if you're an RLL2. And if you did happen to have a CVC drive, you had a big whopping 300 megabytes, so that's why they didn't have much storage for cheap stuff. But then again, guys gathered the volume of information that the whole plant was creating was really a lot of stuff. So yeah, but even from my early days, even with phone modems, the complex stuff, because you remember how long ago I was playing with the DSP stuff, and that's all calculated. And even back then, I would hook up to the machine at home with a telephone modem. I mean, those days are long gone, but today it's not a problem. Anyway, your son could probably walk circles around your calculator and do amazing things, that everything that your calculator can do and more. But, it's whatever you're comfortable with is what you're going to stick with, so... K2RIW,
go ahead, do it again. Agreed. AC2IS, K2RIW, go ahead, Bill.
Hey, Dick. I'm just wondering if you were of, I assume you are, of the calculator I called, I think, HP Prime, and what you thought of that. Can you sort of address the other question I was going to ask with the infrared printer, but I was wondering, you know, you've got this great calculator. How do you get, I know there's an RS-232 interface on it. I don't know if that's convenient to use, but you're talking about doing frequency analysis and stuff, and I think that involves largish amounts of data. How do you easily get data in and out of your HP-48, HP-2IS?
It's an HP-50G, and 99% of the time I put the data in by punching the keyboard, because rarely do I have a great big matrix of data that has to be entered. Very rarely do I do a Fourier transform, or an inverse Fourier transform. And yes, there's a cable you can plug into it, which will interface between the handheld calculator and a desktop, or you can also print out by infrared into the Hewlett-Packard infrared printer, which I use very rarely, because this is a thermal printer, if you know what I mean. It's ancient technology, and maybe HP has a modern-day equivalent of a dot matrix, if you know what I mean. Rarely do I need to get hard copy of what comes out of my handheld calculator. If I need hard copy, then I'll use the desktop and use more conventional laser printer, if you know what I mean. So I do very little interfacing between the handheld calculator and any other machine. It gives me the portable info that I need on that screen, and that suits my needs most of the time. So you mentioned some other kind of calculator. I didn't recognize what you were asking, Bill. Back to you, Bill. KQRIW.
By the way, all the HP calculators sit out of PGL, which means interface to any computer, any printer you want.
Hewlett-Packard language, HPL, very similar to what was way back in the days of 1925. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, it's called HPGL, Hewlett-Packard graphic language, and actually these days it's HPGL2, or PCL6, or PCL7, I think you're on now, but, you know, it's a common protocol, so it's not a big deal, and the infrared is an easy way to grab it, because it doesn't do some of the fancy stuff that today's printers do, but, interfacing to it is not a big deal. You just need a teeny little bit of smarts to do it.
One of the interesting things that can be done with the infrared is I can take a pair of Hewlett-Packard 48, 49, 50 calculators, aim the top of them at each other, and dump computer programs from one to the other by way of infrared. Don't even need an interface. Unfortunately, that's got to be a very close spacing. So the people who made phony stories of where they were aiming the infrared at the ceiling, and two people in a test room were talking to each other through their calculators. There were stories like that. Ain't true. The infrared works over a very short range. AC2IS, K2IW, Granville.
This is AC2IS, and you guys mentioned MATLAB and whether or not it would work on, say, an iPhone. So I did a quick search, and there is a MATLAB mobile, which I quickly installed, but it appears to be a user interface to MATLAB that would be running either in the cloud or on your own computer as opposed to a standalone version of MATLAB. The calculator I was talking about was the H-Prime, supposedly the successor to the HP Model 50. I was wondering if you were aware of that calculator and what you thought of it. Go ahead.
No, I'm not familiar with the HP Prime. And from what you know, Bill, what capability does it have that's above and beyond the HP 50G graphic? Go ahead.
I don't know a lot about it. HP claims that it is the successor to that model. It has a color display. It has a USB port, so it should be more easy to connect it to a modern computer and transfer data. It's got a new programming language called HPPPL, which is supposed to be similar to Pascal. But sometimes referred to as HP Basic. Don't know a lot else about it.